Fraud of Feminism, Part 7, by E. Belfort Bax. Gynecocentric Theory. We must now deal at some length with a fallacy of some importance, owing to the apparatus of learning with which it has been set forth, to be found in Mr. Lester F. Ward's book, entitled Pure Sociology, notwithstanding that its fallacious nature is plain enough once analysed. Mr. Ward terms his speculation the gynecocentric theory, by which he understands, apparently, the feminist dogma of the supreme importance of the female in the scheme of humanity and nature generally. His arguments are largely drawn from general biology, especially that of inferior organisms. He traces the various processes of reproduction in the lower departments of organic nature, subdivision, germination, budding, etc., up to the earlier forms of bisexuality, culminating in conjugation or true sexual union. His standpoint, he thus states, in the terms of biological origins, quote, although reproduction and sex are two distinct things, and although a creature that reproduces without sex cannot properly be called either male or female, still so completely have these conceptions become blended in the popular mind that a creature which actually brings forth offspring out of its own body is instinctively classed as female. The female is the fertile sex, and whatever is fertile is looked upon as female. Assuredly, it would be absurd to look upon an organism propagating sexually as male. Biologists have proceeded from this popular standpoint and regularly speak of mother cells and daughter cells. It, therefore, does no violence to language or to science to say that life begins with the female organism and is carried on a long distance by means of females alone. In all the different forms of asexual reproduction, from fission to parthenogenesis, the female may, in this sense, be said to exist alone and perform all the functions of life, including reproduction. In a word, life begins as female. Close quote. In those remarks, it will be seen that Mr. Ward, so to say, jumps the claim of asexual organisms to be considered as female. This, in itself a somewhat questionable proceeding, serves him as a starting point for his theory. The asexual female, he observes, is not only primarily the original sex, but continues throughout the main trunk, though afterwards the male element is added, for the purposes of fertilisation. Among millions of humble creatures, says Mr. Ward, the male is simply and solely a fertiliser. The writer goes on, in his efforts, to belittle the male sex in the sphere of biology. Quote, the gigantic female spider and the tiny male fertiliser, the mantis insect, with its similarly large and ferocious female, bees and mosquitoes, close quote, all are pressed into the service, even the vegetable kingdom, insofar as it shows signs of sex differentiation, is brought into the lists in favour of his theory of female supremacy, or gynocentrism, as he terms it. This theory may be briefly stated as follows. In the earliest organisms displaying sex differentiation, it is the female which represents the organism proper, the rudimentary male existing solely for the purpose of the fertilization of the female. This applies to most of the lower forms of life, in which the differentiation of sex obtains, and in many insects, the mantis being one of the cases specially insisted upon by our author. The process of the development of the male sex is by means of the sexual selection of the female. From being a mere fertilizing agent, gradually, as evolution proceeds, It assumes the form and characteristics of an independent organism, like the original female trunk organism. But the latter continues to maintain its supremacy in the life of the species, by means chiefly of sexual selection, until the human period, i.e., more or less, for Mr. Ward is bound to admit signs of male superiority in the higher vertebrates, such as birds and mammals. This superiority manifests itself in size, strength, ornamentation, alertness, etc. But it is with man, with the advent of the reasoning faculty, and as a consequence of human supremacy, that it becomes first unmistakably manifest. This superiority, Mr. Ward contends, has been developed under the aegis of the sexual selection of the female, and enabled cruel and wicked man to subject and enslave downtrodden and oppressed woman, who has thus been crushed by a Frankenstein of her own creation. Although in various earlier phases of human organization, woman still maintains her social supremacy, this state of affairs soon changes. Androcracy establishes itself, and woman is reduced to the role of breeding the race and of being the servant of man. Thus, she has remained throughout the periods of the higher barbarism and of civilization. Our author regards the lowest point of what he terms the degradation of woman to have been reached in the past, and the last two centuries as having witnessed a movement in the opposite direction, namely, towards the emancipation of woman and equality between the sexes. The above is a brief, but I think not unfair, skeleton statement of the theory which Mr. Lester Ward has elaborated in the work above referred to in great detail and with immense wealth of illustration. But now I ask, granting the correctness of Mr. Ward's biological premises and the accuracy of his exposition, and I am not specialist enough to be capable of criticizing these in detail, what does it all amount to? The business end, as the Americans would say, of the whole theory, is quite evident. It is to afford a plausible and scientific basis for the modern feminist movement, and thus to further its practical pretensions. What Mr. Ward terms the androcentric theory, at least as regards man and the higher vertebrates, which is, on the face of it, supported by the facts of human experience and has been accepted well nigh unanimously up to recent times, is, according to him, all wrong. The male element in the universe of living things is not the element of primary importance, and the female element, the secondary, but the converse, is the case. For this contention, Mr. Ward, as already pointed out, has, by dint of his biological learning, succeeded at least in making out a case, insofar as lower forms of life are concerned. He has, however, to admit a fatal admission, surely, that evolution has tended progressively to break down the superiority of the female by means, as he contends, of her own sexual selection, and to transfer sex supremacy onto the male, according to Mr. Ward, hitherto a secondary being, and that this tendency becomes very obvious in most species of birds and mammals. With the rise of man, however, out of the Pithecanthropos, the Homo sinensis, or by whatever other designation we may call the intermediate organism between the purely animal and the purely human, and the consequent suppression of instinct as the dominant form of intelligence by reason, the question of superiority, as Mr. Ward candidly admits, is no longer doubtful, and upon the unquestionable superiority of the male, in due course of time, follows the unquestioned supremacy. It is clear, then, that, granting the biological premises of our author, that the lowest sexual organisms are virtually female, and that in the hermaphrodites the female element predominates, that in the earliest forms of bisexuality, the fertilizing or male element was merely an offshoot of the female trunk, and that this offshoot develops mainly by means of sexual selection on the part of the female into an organism similar to the latter, that not until we reach the higher vertebrates, the birds and the mammals, do we find any traces of male superiority, and that this superiority only becomes definite and obvious, leading to male domination in the human species. Granting all this, I say, what argument can be founded upon it in support of the equal value physically, intellectually, and morally of the female sex in human society, or the desirability of its possessing equal political power with men in such society? On the contrary, Mr. Ward's whole exposition, with his biological facts of illustration, would seem to point rather in the opposite direction. We seem surely to have here, if Mr. Ward's premises be accepted as to the primitive insignificance of the male element, at first overshadowed and dominated by the female stem, but gradually evolving in importance, character, and fruition, till we arrive at man, the highest product of evolution up to date, a powerful argument for anti-feminism. On Mr. Ward's own showing, we find that incontestable superiority, both in size and power of body and brain, has manifested itself in androcracy, when the female is relegated, in the natural course of things, to the function of childbearing. This, it can hardly be denied, is simply one more instance of the general process of evolution, whereby the higher being is evolved from the lower, at first weak and dependent upon its parent, the latter remaining dominant until the new being reaches maturity, when in its turn it becomes supreme, while that out of which it developed, and of which it was first the mere offshoot, falls into the background and becomes in its turn subordinate to its own product.
Tune in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
Let us now turn to another scientific fallacy. The result of a good man struggling with adversity, i.e. a sound and honest scientific investigator, but one who at the same time is either himself obsessed with the principles of feminism as with a religious dogma, or else is nervously afraid of offending others who are. His attitude reminds one of nothing so much as that of the orthodox geologist of the first half of the 19th century who wrote in mortal fear of incurring the odium theologicum by his exposition of the facts of geology, and who was therefore nervously anxious to persuade his readers that the facts in question did not clash with the Mosaic cosmogony as given in the book of Genesis. With Mr. Havelock Ellis in his work Man and Woman, it is not the dogma of biblical infallibility that he is concerned to defend, but a more modern dogma, that of female equality, so dear to the heart of the modern feminist. Mr. Ellis's efforts to evade the consequences of the scientific truths he honestly proclaims are almost pathetic. One cannot help noticing, after his exposition of some fact that goes dead against the sex equality theory as contended for by feminists, the eagerness with which he hastens to add some qualifying statement tending to show that, after all, it is not so incompatible with the feminist dogma as it might appear at first sight. The pièce de résistance, however, of Mr. Havelock Ellis is contained in his conclusion. The author has, for his problem, to get over the obvious incompatibility of the truth he has himself abundantly demonstrated in the course of his book, that the woman type, in every respect, physiological and psychological, approaches the child type, while the man type, in its proper progress towards maturity, increasingly diverges from it. The obvious implication of this fact is surely plain. On the principle of the development of the individual, being a shorthand reproduction of the evolution of the species, or to express it in scientific phraseology of ontogeny, being the abbreviated recapitulation of the stages presented by phylogeny. If we proceed on this well-accredited and otherwise universally accepted principle of biology, the inference is clear enough, to wit, that woman is, as Herbert Spencer and others have pointed out, simply undeveloped man. In other words, that woman represents a lower stage of evolution than man. Now, this would obviously not at all suit the book of Mr. Ellis's feminism. Explained away it has to be in some fashion or other. So, our author is driven to the daring expedient of throwing overboard one of the best established generalizations of modern biology and boldly declaring that the principle contained therein is reversed, we suppose for this one occasion only, in the case of man. In this way, he is enabled to postulate a theory, consoling to the feminist soul, which affirms that adult man is nearer in point of development to his pre-human ancestor than either the child or the woman. The physiological and psychological analogies observable between the child and the savage, and even, especially in early childhood, between the child and the lower mammalian types, analogies which, notably in the life of instinct and passion, are traceable readily also in the human female, all these count for nothing. They are not dreamt of in Mr. Ellis's feminist philosophy. The modern feminist dogma requires that woman should be recognized as equal in every respect, except in muscular strength, with man, and if possible as rather superior to him. If nature has not worked on feminist lines, as common observation and scientific research alike testify on the face of things, naughty nature must be corrected, in theory at least, by the ingenuity of feminist savants of the degraded male persuasion. To this end, we must square our scientific hypotheses. I'll just say it's very similar today with racial science. At the time this was written, we weren't having the problem with racial science. We obviously were with the science of the sexes, gender science, as it would be called today. The startling theory of Mr. Havelock Ellis, which must seem, one would think, to all impartial persons, so out of accord with all the acknowledged laws and facts of biological science, appears to the present writer, it must be confessed, the very reductio ad absurdum of feminist controversial perversity. I will conclude this chapter on feminist lies and fallacies with a fallacy of false analogy or false illustration, according as we may choose to term it. This quasi-argument was recently put forward in a defence speech by one of the prisoners in a suffragette trial and was subsequently repeated by George Bernard Shaw in a letter to the Times. Put briefly, the point attempted to be made is as follows. Apostrophising men, it is said, how would you like it if the historical relations of the sexes were reversed? If the making and the administrating of the laws and the whole power of the state were in the hands of women, would not you revolt in such a condition of affairs? Now, to this quasi-argument, the reply is sufficiently clear. The moral intended to be conveyed in the hypothetical question put is that women have just as much right to object to men's domination as men would have to object to women's domination. But it is plain that the point of the whole question resides in a petitio principe, to wit, in the assumption that those challenged admit equal intellectual capacity and equal moral stability as between the average woman and the average man. Failing this assumption, the challenge becomes senseless and futile. If we ignore mental and moral differences, it is only a question of degree as to when we are landed in obvious absurdity. In Gulliver's Travels, we have a picture of society in which horses ruled the roost and lorded it over human beings. In this satire, Swift, in effect, put the question, how would you humans like to be treated by horses as inferiors, just as horses are treated by you today? I am, be it remembered, not instituting any comparison between the two cases, beyond pointing out that the argument as an argument is intrinsically the same in both.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
The psychology of the movement. We have already spoken of two strains in modern feminism, which although commonly found together, are nevertheless intrinsically distinguishable. The first we have termed sentimental feminism, and the second, political feminism. Sentimental feminism is in the main an extension and emotional elaboration of the old notion of chivalry, a notion which, in the period when it was supposed to have been at its zenith, certainly played a very much smaller part in human affairs than it does in its extended and metamorphosed form in the present day. We have already analysed in a former podcast the notion of chivalry. Taken in its most general and barest form, it represents the consideration for weakness, which is very apt to degenerate into a worship of mere weakness. La faiblesse prime le droit is not necessarily nearer justice than la force prime le droit, although to hear much of the talk in the present day, one would imagine that the inherent right of the weak to oppress the strong were a first principle of eternal rectitude. But the theory of chivalry is scarcely invoked in the present day, save in the interests of one particular form of weakness, viz. The woman, as the muscularly weaker sex, and here it has acquired an utterly different character. Chivalry, as understood by modern sentimental feminism, means unlimited license for women in their relations with men and unlimited coercion for men in their relations with women. To men, all duties and no rights. To women, all rights and no duties is the basic principle underlying modern feminism, suffragism, and the bastard chivalry it is so fond of invoking. The most insistent female shrieker for equality between the sexes among the political feminists, it is interesting to observe, will, in most cases, on occasion, be found an equally insistent advocate of the claims of sentimental feminism based on modern metamorphosed notions of chivalry. It never seems to strike anyone that the muscular weakness of woman has been forged by modern feminists into an abominable weapon of tyranny. Under cover of the notion of chivalry, as understood by modern feminism, political and sentimental feminists alike would deprive men of the most elementary rights of self-defence against women and would exonerate the latter practically from all punishment for the most dastardly crimes against men. They know they can rely upon the support of the sentimental section of public opinion with some such parrot cry of, "What? Hit a woman? Well, why not, if she molests you? Treat a woman in this way? Shame!" responds automatically the crowd of sentimental feminist idiots, oblivious of the fact that the real shame lies in their endorsement of an iniquitous sex privilege. If the same crowd were prepared to condemn any special form of punishment or mode of treatment as inhumane for both sexes alike, there would, of course, be nothing to be said. But it is not so. The most savage cruelty and vindictive animosity towards men leaves them comparatively cold, at most evoking a mild remonstrance, as against the inflated manifestation of sentimental horror and frothy indignation produced by any slight hardship inflicted by way of punishment on a female offender. The psychology of sentimental feminism generally is intimately bound up with the curious phenomenon of the hatred of men by their own sex as such. With women, in spite of what is sometimes alleged, one does not find this phenomenon of anti-sex. On the contrary, nowadays we are in the presence of a powerful female sex solidarity, indicating the beginnings of a strong sex league of women against men. But with men, as already said, in all cases of conflict between the sexes, we are met with a callous indifference, alternating with positive hostility towards their fellow men, which seems at times to kill in them all sense of justice. This is complemented, on the other side, by an imbecile softness towards the female sex in general, which reminds one of nothing so much as of the maudlin bonhomie of the amiable drunkard. This besotted indulgence, as before noted, is proof even against the outraged sense of injury to property. As we all know, offences against property, as a rule, are those the average bourgeois is least inclined to condone. Yet, we have recently seen a campaign of deliberate wanton destruction by arson and other means directed expressly against private property, which nevertheless, the respectable propertied bourgeois, the man of law and order, has taken pretty much lying down. Let us suppose another case. Let us imagine an anarchist agitation with a known centre and known leaders, a centre from which daily outrages were deliberately planned by these leaders and carried out by their emissaries, all, bien entendu, of the male persuasion. Now, what attitude does the reader suppose public opinion of the propertied classes would adopt towards the miscreants who were responsible for these acts? Can he not picture to himself the furious indignation, the rabid diatribes, the advocacy of hanging, flogging, penal servitude for life as the minimum punishment, followed by panic legislation along those lines which would ensue as a consequence? Yet of such threatenings and slaughter were suffragettes, who imitate the policy of the terrorist anarchist, are concerned, we hear not a sound. The respectable propertied bourgeois, the man of law and order, will, it is true, probably condemn these outrages in an academic way, but there is an undernote of hesitancy which damps down the fire of his indignation. There is no vindictiveness, no note of atrocity in his expostulations. Nay, he is even prepared on occasion to argue the question, while maintaining the impropriety, the foolishness, the unwomanliness of setting fire to empty houses, cutting up golf links, destroying correspondence, smashing windows, and the like. But a fiery indignation of lurid advocacy of barbaric punishments, or of ferocity in general, we have not a trace. On the contrary, a certain willingness to admit, and even to emphasize, the disinterestedness of these female criminals is observable. As regards this last point, we must again insist on what was pointed out in a previous podcast, that the disinterestedness and unselfishness of many a male bomb-throwing anarchist who has come in for the righteous bourgeois sternest indignation are at least as unquestionable as those of the female house-burners and window-smashers. Moreover, the anarchist, however wrong-headed he may have been in his action, as once before remarked, it must not be forgotten, he at least had for the goal of his endeavours not merely the acquirement of a vote, but the revolution, which he conceived would abolish human misery and raise humanity to a higher level. In this strange phenomenon, therefore, in which the indignation of the bourgeois at the wanton and wilful violation of the sacredness of his idol is reduced to mild remonstrance, and its punitive action to a playful pretense, we have a crucial instance of the extraordinary influence of feminism over the modern mind. That the propertied classes should take arson and willful destruction of property in general with such comparative equanimity because the culprits are women, acting in the assumed interest of a cause that aims at increasing the influence of women in the state, is the most striking illustration we can have of the power of feminism. We have here a double phenomenon, the unreasoning hatred of man as a sex by men, and their equally unreasoning indulgence towards the other sex. As we indicated before, not only is the sense of esprit de corps entirely absent among modern men as regards their own sex, while strongly present in modern women, but this negative characteristic has become positive on the other side. Thus, the modern sex problem presents us with a reversal of the ordinary sociological law of the solidarity of those possessing common interests. It remains to consider the psychological explanation of this fact. Why should men so conspicuously prefer the interests of women before those of their own sex? That this is the case with modern man, the history of the legislation of the last 50 years shows, and the undoubted fact may be found further illustrated in the newspaper reports of well nigh every trial, whether at civil or criminal law, quite apart from the ordinary chivalric acts of men in the detail of social life. This question of sex, therefore, as before said, forms a solitary exception to the general law of the esprit de corps of those possessing common characteristics and interests. It cannot be adequately explained by reference to the evolution of sex functions and relations from primitive man onwards, since it is, at least in the extreme form we see it today, a comparatively recent social phenomenon. The theory of the sacrosanctity of women by virtue of their sex, quite apart from their character and conduct as individuals, scarcely dates back further than a century, even from its beginnings. The earlier chivalry, where it obtained its all, applied only to the woman who presented what were conceived of as the ideal moral feminine characteristics in some appreciable degree. The mere physical fact of sex was never for a moment regarded as of itself sufficient to entitle the woman to any special homage, consideration, or immunity over and above the man. No one suggested that the female criminal was less guilty or more excusable than the male criminal. No one believed that a woman had a vested right to rob or swindle a man because she had had sexual relations with him. This notion of the mere fact of sex, of femality, as of itself constituting a title to special privileges and immunities apart from any other consideration, is a product of very recent times.